this week. The XAU Precious Metals Miners Index added 2%, bucking the downward trend in the markets. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with the first show of 2015. Happy New Year to you all. The program starts off with the market weather recap with a review of each sector and the stories driving the markets. Then two big industry insiders share their outlooks. John Embry, Chief Investment Strategist at Sprott Asset Management, views the mainline mantra of economic recovery in a dim light. He says his new Sprott Gold Miners ETF has eclipsed over $100 million in assets, earning the coveted title of the most successful new ETF of the year. Plus, the gold-ruble ratio shows how the yellow metal exploded over 100% within weeks, shielding holders in that nation from their currency implosion. It's a chart worth viewing. If you'd like a copy, you can go to the webpage or just send a message to me at gsr@hughes.net. And the recent plunge in crude oil price could be a blessing in disguise for the precious metals mining companies, which, as I said, did much better this week. While a lot of the commodities are just breaking down to fresh new lows, you know, lower energy costs boosts the bottom line for a lot of these companies, making operations more profitable. And next up, it's Harry S. Dent Jr., a favorite economist of the show. He says stocks are entering bubble territory, setting the stage for a credit crisis part two. Even though the Dow could add another 2,000 points, that 20,000 level might just be the market zenith, leading to a big sell-off. The next global financial implosion might be the end of all bubbles, with the exception of hard cash. He likes the U.S. dollar and UPP, which hit an all-time record high again this week. As massive global deleveraging unfolds trillions of dollars in debt, it could just lead basically cash and short-term government bonds in the black. But ultimately, there could be a silver lining here. The economic carnage will make things much less expensive for most Americans who are struggling today and folks around the world. Home prices and related goods and services, well, will be affordable once again. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy weather hovered over the precious metals sector this week on yet another record high in the U.S. dollar index. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was off about $6, about 0.5%, ending at $11.89 an ounce. Silver was off just 30 cents, about 2%, finishing at $15.78, while the XAU and silver equities index closed at the highest level in 6 weeks. Up 2%, 2 points at 70.5. But West Texas Intermediate crude dropped about $1, off 2% for the week, ending at $56.52 a barrel. The top story driving the markets, the U.S. dollar index, which closed at an 8-year high, due in no small part to plunging global currency alternatives. Emerging markets continue to struggle, with the yellow metal in ruble terms soaring over 100% in just a few weeks. Investors are seeking refuge from the plunging currency amid that crude oil slide, the number one sector, you might say, for the nation. The interesting aspect of the story is the abrupt climb in gold relative to rubles. Few, I think, if any investors anticipated the move, and gold had been essentially in a bearish market in terms of rubles for about a year. And then suddenly, in just a few weeks' time, over 100% gain. Some top analysts expect this to become a theme in 2015, where investors simply make a mad dash to the yellow metal. Elsewhere, Goldman Sachs set its long-term forecast for gold at about $1,200 an ounce for the next 3 years, citing the price as the cost of production for most gold miners. Jewelry purchases up 534 tons this year. That was over half the total gold demand, were solid thanks to, once again, India, where demand leaped over 60% in the third quarter, according to the World Gold Council. How come, you might ask? A big component to this story is the Reserve Bank of India's decision to end their 80-20 rule, which essentially forced importers to sell 20% of their shipments for re-export. That's increasing demand substantially. And plus China, of course, a voracious appetite, its central bank. One interesting story, anecdote, came from a top insider this week who believes that China may have many times its national stockpile in gold, and they're just waiting for the right time to announce it to the world. Meantime, central banks added about 93 tons of gold to reserves in the third quarter, with more than half of all buying coming from Russia, according to the World Gold Council. Central bank purchases are expected to hit more than 400 tons for the year, similar to 2013. On the domestic economic front, U.S. weekly unemployment claims increased above expectations, nearly 300,000, approaching that benchmark point where recessions tend to loom. Higher unemployment is usually good for gold as investors anticipate counteractive measures from the Fed. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the U.S. dollar rally has continued unabated for over 7 months and closed yet again at a new high on flight to quality from peripheral emerging market currencies. Is this the beginning of a new multi-year trend? Well, maybe, maybe not. Either way, the move is virtually parabolic. In the past decade, however, there have been two similar advances in the dollar, equally as prolonged and steep both times, but the greenback fell back to the mean. And interestingly, the XAU blasted higher, as I mentioned, at the top of its range as investors turned to mining companies due to lower energy costs. Caution, I think, though, for the time being, is still advisable on the sector. I'd like to see the U.S. dollar roll over a bit. Well, moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors booked profits on sluggish employment numbers. Fewer jobs tends to depress corporate sales and share prices. The Dow lost 220 points, off just 1%, and ending at 17,832. And the S&P 500 dropped about 30, off 1.5%, finishing at 20,058, while the NASDAQ was down 80, 1.5%, finishing at 47,026. Well, U.S. stocks seem to be poised for a third consecutive winning year of double-digit returns on solid economic growth, tame inflation, and virtually nil interest rates. However, Professor Emeritus Burton Malkiel at Princeton University is my guest next week, and he just told me that he does not expect this pace to continue much longer. He has an interesting metric he calls the CAPE price-to-earnings metric. Listen in next week for his must-hear comments for the new year. Still, after closing above the psychologically important 18,000 level last week, traders were unable to hold the Dow over that level. Nevertheless, investors piled into U.S.-based stock ETFs this year at the fastest clip on record, adding $143 billion for the year. That eclipsed last year by over $6 billion. U.S. stock ETFs have surpassed $2 trillion for the first time on record. It sounds eerily similar to the go-go rah-rah dot-com bubble. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our seven-indicator sentiment composite index remains in the fearful zone. However, there's no signs of panic really showing up just yet. I view this as a somewhat bearish sign for next week, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a little selling early in the week. And remember, we'd like to have you join us for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. If you haven't yet signed up, you can do so at our webpage. 5 new stocks each week and a balanced portfolio with bonds and commodities and everything you need to have a more solid and profitable portfolio this year. We do it scientifically, the hard numbers and statistics, to give us more rigorous analysis and better and improved probability of success. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Harry S. Dent Jr. and John Embry. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Harry S. Dent Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, and many bestsellers. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, nice to be back, Chris.
Quite an interesting year in the markets. Seemed to catch a lot of people off guard. You know, you're one of our only guests to predict the U.S. dollar rally.
Well, no, you know, we were kind of seeing the dollar going back to its highs, which it's done. It's slightly exceeded that. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the dollar takes a little break here for a few months. But we see the dollar going higher. And we see, it's funny, like the dollar trades against all the risk on assets, everything else. It trades against other currencies. It trades against stocks and commodities. So sometime in 2015, not quite yet, the market still looks like it has upward momentum, at least for a few months. And we're still in the bubble from our point of view. And that's my biggest statement to the world, is this is a bubble. Everybody on CNBC and Wall Street say, oh, no, it's not a bubble because of this and this and this. It's a bubble. And what people don't understand about bubbles, it does not matter what causes them, whether it's excessive stimulus and low interest rates from the government or supply, you know, insufficient supply versus demand in real estate or you know, speculation or whatever. When stocks go up like this so steeply, or real estate or anything, they're going to come down. And they're going to come down hard. Bubbles don't crack, they burst. So my forecast is that sometime in 2015, my best guess is around March, that we peak at 19,000, maybe 20,000 on the Dow, and we see the biggest crash of our lifetimes. You know, we see the Dow drop in the next few years down to 6,000 and maybe ultimately lower, but we're going to see a classic 70% plus crash, which you see after every major bubble in history. Bubbles don't crack 10 or 20% or go down slowly. They usually crash 60, 70, 80% within 2 to 3 years. I'm saying not quite yet. Stocks don't look ready to top. You know, we may see a little correction here, but it looks like to me they're going to keep going up at least for the next few months.
Well, that's certainly been one of the biggest themes here of 2014. Stocks, the place to park assets, and a lot of money, a lot of capital flows from the rest of the world looking for a place to participate in a rally, particularly with so much currency unrest outside of our shores. So you think there's going to be a flight to safety at some point in 2015?
Yeah, I mean, bubbles always defeat themselves. People always have rationales for bubbles, but any bubble goes so high that people can't afford it anymore. And people are saying stocks are not that overvalued. It's something like 18 times earnings. Well, 18 times earnings is well higher than average. And if you adjust the price earnings ratios for cyclicality, which Robert Shiller does, we're really at 27-28, which is higher than most bubble peaks and stock market peaks in history outside of 1929 and 2000, which were the largest bubbles. But, you know, they always destroy themselves. And same with real estate. I mean, New York's having its best year ever. Condos are selling for anywhere from $5,000 to $13,000 a square foot. That's ridiculous. It's going to get to the point where only rich Chinese can buy anything, and you just run out of demand. I mean, bubbles defeat themselves. So, you know, we've got a real estate bubble around the world. And many places never even took a hit like the U.S. took in 2006 to 2012. Canada kept going up. China kept going up. Mumbai's kept going up. Singapore's kept going up. Australia, you know, London, Paris, Rome are at ridiculous prices. And these are going to burst. And people think real estate can't go down because they haven't seen it go down in their lifetime. But if you study history, real estate's pretty much nearly as volatile as stocks. And the second thing people don't get about real estate that Robert Shiller, you know, basically discovered, if you adjust real estate for inflation and the size, average size of houses, it's not an appreciating asset. It doesn't go up.
Dr. Shiller took the index back 100 years or more. It has a tendency to revert to the mean.
Again, adjusted for inflation, it doesn't go up at all. It's not an appreciating asset. Real estate is more like we were taught in Monopoly. That basically you buy it for the rents, or you buy it, you buy a house to avoid paying rent, you know, and get a mortgage or buy instead. But it's the income from the property. The real estate does generate income, but it does not appreciate like stocks do. Stocks, if you go back in the same time period that Shiller did and adjust for inflation, stock averaged 7% adjusted for inflation. Stocks are an appreciating asset. Real estate is not. You should buy real estate to turn out a positive cash flow, or because you're going to live in it and save the rent for your investment. That's the reason you should buy it.
Okay, now keeping with the market bubble theme, things getting frothy, we also tend to see more of a very steep rise before bubbles end. Do you expect to see this equities rally start to display signs of irrational exuberance?
Well, first of all, if you track the market, especially since the only decent correction we've had since 2009 and all this stimulus was in 2011. From there on, stocks have gone up more parabolic. And I've seen people who place a theoretical bubble over the Dow or S&P, and it tracks almost exactly, and it looks very close to peaking. So it already has been parabolic, but I remind people that this is different. And if you look back in history, you usually see one great bubble like the Roaring Twenties or the 90s in tech stocks or, you know, you go back in 1830s and, you know, 1860s and 70s. There'll be one big bubble and then it'll crash. We've never had a situation where governments around the world have literally decided, oh, we're not going to let the bubbles crash and we're just going to keep them going. Now we've had three bubbles. You know, the one that peaked in early 2000, the one that peaked in late 2007, and now this one. And so you can't expect, I don't compare this bubble to the 90s bubble. I don't compare the price-earnings ratio to that time, because in the 90s, and I was one of the few people that saw this, we had the strongest spending of the largest generation in history, the strongest spending pattern. On top of that, the internet was moving mainstream along with cell phones and all these new technologies, just like automobiles and electricity and phones, back in the Roaring Twenties. And we had a geopolitical environment that was hunky-dory. Nothing was wrong in the world. There was no big Middle East Arab Spring. There was no Russia rolling into Ukraine. You know, no planes weren't falling out of the skies every other week. You know, it was a whole different environment. And now we're in a very risky world, and we're in a third bubble that's been now totally artificially created. This recovery, this bubble would not have happened without $14 trillion of money being pulled out of the thin air by every central bank in the world, if you put them all together, you know, $4 trillion just from us. This wouldn't have happened. So to me, this is actually a worse bubble. No, the valuations are not quite as high as in early 2000, but this bubble has nothing under it except for stimulus. I mean, the bubble of the 90s had the strongest economy in U.S. history and in world history, and the fundamentals supported that. And then that's what most bubbles do. You get a really good economy with falling interest rates, and then people just go nuts and start at some point buying stocks and real estate and things just because they're going up, and they lose the fundamentals, and then you get that frothy thing you're talking about. The best chart I have, Chris, is just plotting the S&P 500 in a channel since 2011, and it's following that channel. We're on the upper end of that channel, so I don't think there's a lot of potential. To me, there's two scenarios here. Either we keep edging up over the next few months, and that would give us a Dow about 19,000 and an S&P about 2175, and stay within this channel on the top side and then collapse at some point. Or we break above this channel, and you do get a very frothy thing, and next thing you know, we're 20,000 Dow in March. I am looking, our cyclical work suggests that we're going to get a peak in 2015. Mid-March is the most likely time. So I'm looking at two scenarios, a Dow 19,000 by then, or if we get really frothy, 20,000. Either way, if that happens, I'm very likely to be telling people, okay, get out of the stock market. We're already telling people get out of real estate because real estate is harder to get out of, gets very illiquid. And I see another real estate crash larger than the one we saw last time around and more global. It's going to happen almost everywhere.
I don't think it really takes an advanced degree in history or economics to recognize some commonalities that occur at market zeniths. Every market bubble tends to lead to another bubble. We've seen this over and over again. You could say there's some government complicity, but for the most part, we've seen those capital flows shift somewhere else. Where do you see the next bubble? Because if you're talking about a bubble in equities, more than likely, you've got your eye on another market or two where much of the money will flow.
Well, you know, Chris, I don't see another bubble. And I'll tell you what, that has been our theme now for over a decade, that what we're just seeing is one bubble after the next. We've had three stock bubbles now. You know, we've had a real estate bubble that's gone down. Now we've got a mini bubble. We saw commodities bubble across the board, one after the next. And gold was the last to peak. And the CRB peaked back in 2008. But gold didn't peak until late 2011. So we've seen one bubble after the next. We've seen a bond bubble. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago you'd see a 10-year treasury at 1.38%, which we saw a few years ago, or Japanese today at 0.4%, and German bonds as low as 0.7%. I mean, that is below inflation rates. That is negative return. So that's a bubble. But at some point, when the government can no longer support this thing, or they blow it up so far that it just blows up, then the bubble's in, because money gets destroyed very rapidly, and debts, when debts fail, money gets destroyed. When financial assets fall 60, 70, 80, 90%, money disappears. And the last time that happened, the government just said, well, okay, trillions of dollars disappeared in net worth and income. Well, we'll just throw it back in. And that's what they did. But they've only blown up a bigger bubble. I've been saying for a long time now, the danger from central banks and the Fed creating money out of nothing is not inflation, because they're fighting deflation. The danger is they create a bigger bubble that bursts, and when the bubble bursts, the whole thing blows up and people lose confidence in the system and the Fed. I mean, last time the Fed stepped in and printed all this money. Well, this time, how are they going to come in? If we have another collapse in markets and the economy, how are they going to come in and say, well, we're going to do what we did last time, create more money? I think people will say, no, it didn't work.
Okay, but let's take the opposite side of that coin for a moment. They've been quite creative in their machinations, I think you'd agree. And for instance, they have a tendency to come up with interesting new names, new policies that very few folks have heard of before. Of course, it's really just the same game with a different moniker attached to it, but they've already systematically monetized most of the outstanding mortgage debt, what's going to stop them from simply monetizing all the bad debts and wiping away much of this deflation that you see?
Well, what's going to stop them is we get another financial crisis, because they have blown up bubbles. When you make money free or negative returns, it's always going to go into speculation, and we've seen speculation everything. Let me give you a scenario, and I think the market's totally missing this right here with all this bubble mania, and it is the only place money can go, so people rationally. We just had oil prices fall from $106 to $53 in 6 months, and that was after it fell in 4.5 months from $147 to $32 last time around. It's going to fall further. What happens when the fracking bubble bursts? And it's all that fracking's done. It's over. It's not a wonder new technology that's going to create a new industry in the U.S. Only abnormally high oil prices and free money allow these frackers to be profitable, and only at, you know, between $55 and $90 prices. They're not low-cost producers. They are high-cost producers. Now that oil has fallen, and it will fall further because these frackers may be unprofitable now, which means they're not going to be able to pay back their debts, a lot of junk bonds, and they're 20% of the junk bond market. That bubble's going to burst. And oil keeps falling, and the market's like, well, it's good for the economy. It's good for consumers, but it's not good. It's going to knock out one of the growth industries of the last several years in this bubble, the whole fracking on oil and natural gas business. It's just going to be knocked out. Nobody's going to invest in this. There's going to be no more jobs day to day. Texas is almost guaranteed to go into a major recession like they did in the 1980s when the rest of the country was booming. That's oil prices crashed then. That starts a bubble. You know, and there's $500 trillion in leveraged and junk bond debt there. The next bubble to burst, the U.S., through bonds and bank lending, U.S. dollar loans to emerging country companies who are getting killed by falling commodity prices. We've been predicting for years commodity prices would burst. And their burst, this kills emerging countries and their best industries. That debt is going to blow up. And with the U.S. dollar going up, which we also predicted and have been predicting, it gets harder and harder to pay back those debts. That's $5.7 trillion. There's another debt bubble that blows. And then blah, 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 then the economy slows and real estate goes down. And then you get these. All it takes is something to trigger these bubbles, these debt bubbles burst. All it took was a subprime crisis in four states last time. That's all it took to cause an entire global collapse.
No, exactly. California and Florida leading the pack there. It's quite an ominous scenario, but we've heard this mantra for decades. You know, there's always a bull market somewhere. It sounds to me like the only bull market you're forecasting, once again, is cash.
It is cash. Now, this is another thing, Chris, that people don't understand. In the 1970s, we had a big inflation global crisis. Well, there was a bull market in emerging countries, in commodities, in gold, and Japan was doing well in an off-cycle demographic. There were plenty of places you could have made money. In the 1930s, when we had a deflationary bust, there was no place to go. Utilities went down. Casinos went down. Stocks, large cap, small cap, high dividend, low dividend, real estate, commodities, everything went down. People don't understand that. If you don't understand history and if you don't understand that there's four seasons of our economy and once in a lifetime, you're going to get a bubble burst, a deflationary, debt deleveraging, financial speculation deleveraging crisis. In that crisis, there is no real bull market with the exception of cash and the highest quality bonds.
But let's look back then, circa 2008-2009, even earlier, a somewhat similar scenario that you're outlining here. There was nowhere to hide.
Commodities, real estate, large cap, small cap, U.S., Europe, emerging country stocks, everything went down except the U.S. dollar and high-quality bonds in Germany.
But I would argue that the yellow metal held up remarkably well. There was only really a one-month dip.
I better than stocks did.
And that leads me to the next point here. If we do see some type of meltdown, as you're outlining, and this could run a little longer, the equities rally might surprise people on the upside. That's what bubbles tend to do.
That's what they do.
That just brings in the poor last individual. In that scenario, people have to start thinking a bit more defensively. My guess is you would like to see portfolios rebalancing in 2015.
Short-term treasuries are fine. I think long-term treasuries for a short period of time will spike up. People would even question that safe haven. But if one of the things we're looking for investors, if the 10-year U.S. Treasury goes to the top of a kind of declining channel we've charted now since 1989, about 3.5 to 3.7% return, we would tell people to buy those bonds, lock in those yields, because I think you're going to see yields ultimately in a deflationary period, even lower than we saw at 1.38%. I mean, the U.S. Treasury could go under 1% years from now. So, but I wouldn't buy the bonds now. We're in the middle of that channel at 2.2% roughly. You know, the low point was 1.38. The high was a little over 3. I'd want to see yields get higher. Then I would buy bonds. That is one place I would buy highest quality. And then I would buy the longest term treasury. I'd buy the 30-year and lock in, you know, maybe a 4.5% yield and then watch that thing drop back to 2% or lower and then the 10-year drop to 1% or lower. You'd get good income, better than dividends on stocks, and you'd get appreciation while stocks and real estate and everything else goes down.
All right. Well, every complex system has its tipping point. The stock market certainly has many of the characteristics of a chaotic system. What is the focal point that you're watching for? Are you expecting the Fed to eventually have to pull the trigger on rates?
The Fed is not going to raise rates because the economy is going to suck so bad they're not going to be able to. Our demographics, the only trends that saw the fall of Japan in the late 80s before it happened and the boom in the 90s in the U.S. and Europe and the world says Europe's going to get weaker, especially Germany in the next year. The U.S., the only people still spending, the top 10 to 20% of affluent people, they're going to weaken demographically. The biggest thing I'm watching, though, to trigger, I'm watching the price of oil. I think the price of oil within 2015, before the end of 2015, and probably sooner, is going to go back to $32. And then the fracking industry is clearly dead. People are still hoping, oh, this is temporary in oil, and we'll be back at 80 to 100 in no time. We're not going back above 80. That's our forecast, and I don't think we'll get that high, but that's the highest I see. Oil broke down, just like gold and other major commodities, out of a long, multi-channel. When it does that, you're going to fall as much as that channel, and you're not likely to go back into that channel again for a long time. So oil's not coming back, but when it hits 30, 40 bucks, people are going to realize, oh, this whole fracking industry is dead. It's not just dead for a few years. It's dead for a long time, if not forever.
quite a dichotomy. On the one hand, sure, it will injure the heartland of the United States, which has had a boom period here of the last decade. Yeah, thanks to fracking, as you say. But on the other hand, lower energy prices tends to boost corporate profits and bottom lines.
Chris, all we got to do, I keep telling people, look back at history. Oil went from 147 to 32 bucks in 2008, and we were in a recession for a year after that. Oh, ultimately, it may have helped, but when prices fall that dramatically, it's showing how weak the economy is, number one. It's showing bubble bursting, number two, and overcapacity. And it's not a good thing in the short term to fall that. It's different if oil went from 100 bucks to 80 slowly and then 80 maybe down to 70. Yeah, that's good. But a crash like this, last time around, the bubble in debt was not in high-yield bonds. It was in subprime mortgage. So this time, the bubble has been in high-yield bonds. It's going to burst the high-yield bubble. That's going to cause high-yield interest rates for corporate bonds and emerging countries who pay even higher to skyrocket. They've already jumped from 5 to 7% in a short period of time, and the bonds on fracking companies and energy companies have jumped 0.5% to 10%. But what happens if it's 15 or 20? None of these companies can borrow anymore. The debt market collapses, and that's how this trigger gets rolling. And the more debt goes bad, the more bondholders take a scrutiny to all debt and raise interest rates. That's how even the 10-year Treasury could get to 3.5%. High-yield bonds, last time we had a crisis, they went from 7.5% to 23.5%. Well, this time they could go from 5% to 25% to 30%. That's how you get a debt crisis.
So then again, what should investors be watching as a trigger point? Would you then want to see the primary theme in the major equities, U.S. equities markets, to roll over? Would that be the ultimate sell signal here?
They may take some little corrections, but I think they're going to keep edging up. If they keep edging up into March, that's one thing I'm looking for. That's going to be a danger signal. Better than that, what I'm expecting to happen is oil to find a bottom here temporarily, maybe around 49, 50 bucks, and then to rally back towards the kind of 70s where it kind of broke out dramatically. If oil, a few months, and gets back somewhere between like 64 and 76, let's call it, if it gets back in that range and then starts to fall again near term in the next several months, oil has another major leg down. This does not look like a bottom, not on the chart patterns, not any point of view, and there's only one support level for oil below this kind of $75 to $80 range that it broke after many years, and that's 32 bucks, the 2008 low. And so if oil starts to fall again, it's going to crash again, and that's when the reality about the high yield bond market and the whole fracking and energy industries is going to hit, and that's what triggers the collapse. And the Fed can't do anything about that.
But, you know, during the 2008 crisis, oil really coincided. It was more of a coincidental indicator with the equities market. This time, equities are holding up well.
Well, that's another difference we have this time. The Fed, central banks, especially here in the United States, have created an environment with super low, cheap, everything else. Commodities have been falling overall in the last several years. Bonds have been sideways. Real estate's recovered, but timidly in most places. There's been no, stocks are the only game. Fed, the central banks have made it so you've got to go into stocks, especially high dividend stocks you use. So stocks are the last bubble. They're the only place left to go. And that's why stocks are doing well. But look at, I mean, stocks. Oil is crashing. Nothing could be more obvious than these fracking companies, which are. They've created over a million jobs. It's Texas has been the strongest state in the country. Now it's going to be the weakest. How could people ignore that these companies are not going to be able to pay back their debt in these junk bonds and that this is the next subprime crisis? And we got to remember, in 2008, even Bernanke, everybody said, oh, the subprime thing, it's no big deal and the banks can handle it. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. Four states triggered a global crisis and nobody saw it coming except for a few people. The markets are ignoring this extremely obvious high-yield bond and fracking bubble, and it's going to burst, and fracking was BS from the beginning.
Now, when the whole edifice implodes, as you clearly see sometime in 2015, what emerges? What's the market du jour at that point?
Well, basically, it's a reset. And this is good. I mean, we had at the last reset, big reset we had was 1930 to 33. And it's the biggest crash in U.S. history. But from there, real estate bottomed forever and only went up. Stocks bottomed forever and only went up. The economy recovered, a few recessions here and there. But we did nothing but boom after that. It clears the debts. When you eliminate a lot of debt from the economy, and when financial assets come down and become more affordable, including real estate and housing, which is the biggest cost that families have, it's a good long-term thing.
John and Jane Q. Public are going to really get caught between the vice.
I'll tell you, Chris, who's going to get caught. And I'm just doing an article for this in my newsletter. Income inequality. 0.01% have done better than the top. 0.1% have done way better than the top. 1% have done way better than the top. 10% on and down. Negative income gains when you adjust it for inflation all the way back to, I don't know, 1970 or 1980 or something. I mean, the rich have been getting richer, and when this bubble bursts, since the rich own, the top 10% own 85% of the wealth in this country, 85% to just 10%. These people are going to get annihilated more. It was the rich that got hit the hardest in the 1930s and after that. The middle class actually started to rise from that great reset. So I'm telling people, it's the people, yes, this, people are going to lose jobs, houses are going to go underwater again, foreclosures, all this sort of stuff, but this is going to be a marginal loss for those people. The richest people in the world are going to lose their assets at the fastest rate since the 1930s. And you're going to see, you know, billionaires go down to millionaires, that sort of thing.
You notice that the cash deals in housing comprised most of the purchases in the past few years. That's emblematic of institutions buying up with their huge assets, complements of the U.S. Fed.
There's no place to go. Stocks. And like you say, buying cash, buying real estate for cash and foreclosures and turning it around and renting it because it's not so easy to sell it. That's going to end. I mean, that's another little bubble, you know, and people are thinking real estate's going to come back stronger than ever. I've done extensive, and I mean extensive research on real estate, and I am telling people unequivocally, real estate will never be the same in our lifetime. Never, ever, ever. And you look at Japan, they're now down for the 23rd year on the bottom. 23 years. Why? Because there's more old people dying than young people buying. The net demand for real estate, because of the fact that the millennial generation in most countries, wealthy countries in the world, is not as large as the baby boomers, you're going to get this thing where, because real estate's different from other assets, it never ends. It lasts forever. So when old people die, they become sellers. And when there's more sellers than buyers, there's no demand for real estate. Real estate's not going to come roaring back, and people who are speculating in it, you should be buying real estate, as I said earlier, to rent it out. If you can buy real estate in foreclosure, like a 2-3-bedroom house, and rent it out for 5-10% positive cash flow, that's a good investment. But if you're buying it because you think it's going to come roaring back, you're going to be disappointed. My mother used to invest and run, you know, condos. She had 6 or 7 condos. She said she would never do that again, ever, ever. It's such a pain.
Though I know you keep an eye on the charts and the technical analysis here on housing, you know, it's been sideways for 2 years. We've had no positive growth.
It has been slowing, and people are not noticing that. Real estate is not going to lead us down this time like it did last time. It's going to be more this fracking bubble and high-yield bond. But when the economy slows, of course, real estate's going to go down again. And one of the things we look at bubbles, and it's one of these universal principles, like bubbles always burst, and they always go higher than the last bubble and all this sort of stuff, but bubbles, 95% of the time, when bubbles burst, they go back to where they became bubbles. You know, not back to the last low 20 years ago or something, but where it got bubbly. And then real estate bubble, by my calculation, started in January of 2000. Just to January of 2000, not way back to the 1950s or 60s or early 80s, real estate would have to fall 40-some percent from here.
Well, you know, Dr. Schill is certainly on board with you. He has been right, at least on his longer-term outlook now for over a decade and a half. What you're rolling out here is a pretty frightening concept, because what that implies, this is the largest component, you could argue, of remaining economy.
It is. And like you say, for the average person, they have more net worth in their house doing stocks. So that for the typical rich person, they have much more in financial assets like stocks and bonds and commodities and stuff. But yes, and this is something you live in. You can be foreclosed on. You've got debt against. A housing crash historically is much worse than a stock crash. Can a stock crash, well, disappears overnight and a lot of people get hit hard, but it's the wealthy that hold all these stocks. A housing crash hits everybody, and it's very deep, and we've seen how hard it was to recover from the last one. Well, this one's going to be worse by my estimate.
Corporate buybacks tends to coincide with stronger equities markets as, you know, the big companies, they reduce their float outstanding. Basic supply and demand tends to lead to higher prices.
Yeah, it's like the fracking. It's another bubble. How did these buybacks happen so easily? Because the Federal Reserve has given money away for free. Short-term rates are zero. Long-term rates are at or above inflation, which means zero. Money is free. When money's free and companies aren't growing, I just saw a thing the other day. IBM sales, I don't know, 5-10% lower than they were 5 or 6 years ago, yet the stock is way higher. Why? Buybacks. Companies are buying back their own stocks with very cheap money, and they're not investing in the future because they don't see the growth, and they say, well, hey, how do we help our shareholders? We buy back our own stock. That's artificial, and it's only made if they had to pay, you know, 6% for that money instead of 2% or something, that wouldn't be so profitable. When governments manipulate interest rates and make money free, every time in history that's happened, including the great land rush in the Midwest, where the biggest bubble burst in U.S. history in real estate was Chicago in the 1830s. Because the government gave away free land and then financed it with cheap money and created a bubble. When you make people will abuse it, speculate, you get bubbles, and then they burst.
It seems as though there's really almost two statements here. If you had to sum up 2015, firstly, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, particularly with regard to financial assets. But then on the other hand, there isn't going to be a lot of places to go, that the next bubble might just be holding cash.
And there's nothing wrong with sitting on cash while everything goes down, because it's not true you don't get a return on that cash. You get a return in direct proportion to how much everything else falls, because the cash keeps its value, everything else falls. So you can buy gold, you can buy real estate, you can buy great companies down the road. It's, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar. That's how you make a fortune in a deflationary downturn. You don't make it through diversification and asset allocation, because that doesn't, it's the one time in a lifetime that diversification doesn't work, because as we talked earlier, everything goes down.
But couldn't you just make the case, though, for those who really don't have too much choice with diversification? Because there are a lot of people listening to our voices today that are forced to hold, you know, maybe 401ks, but they find themselves in that position. You know, you could always allocate a large portion, if it's a possibility, into something like UUP.
UUP is the ETF that tracks the U.S. dollar. Doesn't do it perfectly, but it's the best option. You know, but also if you're in a 401k plan and, you know, you got large cap stocks, small cap stocks, high yield bonds, emerging markets, and low yield bonds, safe bonds, take the safest, shortest term, most government-like bonds and put your allocation there. And if you can be in UUP, the dollar has been the safe haven thus far every time we've had a crisis, or be in a money market, the closest to cash you can get, because that's the one thing that won't go down.
Very good. Harry Dent, please tell people more about the services you provide and how they can find out more about them on the web, please.
Go to harrydent.com and you can sign up for our free newsletter. Actually, we changed it to Economy and Markets. You just go there, put in your website, and you're done. You get on our newsletter. It comes out 6 days a week. It's great content, and it just lets people get to know us better. Because like you say, we have a very different view than most people, so we like to educate people, and people can just be on that free newsletter until they decide to do something else with us.
As always, I point out that competing viewpoints tend to lead to, you know, I think a better overview of what's headed in the market. So you just can't put on the blinders. These markets are a little bit more sophisticated than that. All right, Harry Dent Jr., we want to thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
John Embree is an industry expert in the precious metals. He's researched the sector for decades. He's a senior advisor at Sprott Asset Management. Welcome back, John Embree.
Chris, it's a delight.
You know, I thought we could start off today with some interesting topicality. The New York Sun headlines that I think makes those of us who monitor the markets cringe. It said, kaboom, Dow 18,000. And I think the irony of that statement is, you know, eventually there might just be a kaboom, but not on the upside. The headline, made the top of the Drudge Report. It's linked everywhere from Bloomberg around the world. Yes, it's the highest close in the Dow's history. We haven't seen anything like it. Our economy apparently is firing on all eight cylinders. It seems to be garnering most of the attention of investors out there, but no bull market lasts forever. What do you see for 2015 for stocks, and how do you think that could impact the precious metals?
Well, I think that what we're seeing, Chris, is like brilliant propaganda. I mean, the story that is being delivered is that the U.S. economy is now recovering strongly, I guess. Employment's improving, and the stock market is reflective of all this. And in my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth. I do not believe the U.S. economy has any vitality. I mean, basically, it's kind of holding in there because they're putting enough money into the system that it doesn't collapse. And quite frankly, it does look better than a number of other economies in the world, Europe, Japan, etc. But nevertheless, it doesn't underwrite the kind of price action we've seen in the stock market. These price action in the stock market, I don't believe there's any true price discovery going on. I think there's massive manipulation of all markets, and it's absolutely essential for confidence reasons that the stock market be seen to be doing well. And I think that is the major factor behind the pricing. But unfortunately, you can only sort of avert reality for a while. At some point, I think there will be a day of reckoning. Whether it's in 2015 or later, I'm not sure. But I would be extremely careful if I were an investor today in the traditional stock market.
Harry Stint also recommends, you know, strong diversification away from overpriced financial assets. And maybe that's a good transition into another interesting topic. Most people don't follow the Russian ruble. It's not, I think, a trader's favorite. It's not a market that we hear a lot about. But when priced in terms of gold in terms of rubles might be a better way. It's one of the more interesting charts, and I've placed this chart up on the website with this interview along with you today so people can get a visual illustration of just how gold in terms of ruble also rolled over, just as we've seen in virtually every currency, up until this year. And it started to turn around a little bit. And before you know it, in less than 2 months, just a few weeks, gold in terms of ruble skyrocketed over 100%. Then I know people say, oh, well, that's because the oil price crashed. Obviously, it was a safe haven. Well, that's easy to say in retrospect. You know, we look into the rearview mirror. Don't you think that precious metals component that no one was probably thinking of in Russia. In fact, gold had just lost 50% of its value until this year. And all of a sudden, it shoots up over 100%. Just a modicum of gold in a portfolio would have shielded any investor in Russia. Shouldn't we be thinking along those lines here in the West?
Chris, that's an excellent point. You know, I mean, I think people basically just don't pay attention. Like, I was in Argentina earlier this year when the peso was falling apart. And I was thinking, like, anybody that owns gold in Argentina is fine. And yet the average citizen was getting crushed. And it's happening in more and more places. Like, and to take the point further, like, if you actually analyze the finances of Russia, they're going through a hard time right now because I think they're being geopolitically attacked. And part of this reason for the low oil prices, they're trying to sort of really destroy Russia. But the fact is that if you look at their finances, they're in infinitely better state than the United States. They don't have nearly the debt. And I think it's a great indicator to the citizen in America and in Canada, for that matter. They'd think you've got to have some diversification in the asset that basically doesn't have any, counterparty risk. Counterparty risk is going to be a huge problem going forward. Gold bullion has zero counterparty risk, and I think it should be in every portfolio.
No, it's well said. And, you know, with all of this money printing, trillions of dollars, arguably over $15 to $20 trillion by central bankers, and just in recent years since the credit crisis, From 2000 up until today, the ruble has debased 95% in terms of gold. Now, to illustrate the significance of folks who actually had the foresight to add some of the yellow metal or silver, this means that a $50,000 investment would now have the purchasing power of $1 million or rubles, but five times the increase that we've seen in the U.S. dollar, gold in terms of U.S. dollars. Now, again, highlight, underscore, embolden the significance here because we never know. Markets are a bit more tricky, I think, than a lot of people. They're called complex systems. When that tipping point could come with the U.S. dollar, but when it does, it usually strikes like a lightning bolt.
I couldn't agree more. Like, I think basically the United States dollar, I guess, has been about the strongest currency in the world recently. And if you actually look at the, you know, the reality, I mean, it's it doesn't deserve to be. But more importantly, I mean, it's starting to put pressure on the U.S. economy. I mean, the fact is that the dollar is too strong now. Well, from an industrial point of view, I mean, basically export-imports is going to start working against the United States. I think it'll probably happen in 2015 that the dollar problem, I think that's got the people in Washington terrified, because if that were to happen, interest rates would rise. And the one thing that the North American economy cannot tolerate is higher interest rates. It would just bring the whole scene to a grinding halt. So, I mean, your point's well taken. I mean, the fact is that there's a lot of stuff out there that can go very badly wrong, and yet most people have no diversification away from the fact that everything looks wonderful.
Well, you know, there's been such a flood of money, and of course, then the institutions and the banks, especially globally, they have no better place to park it than U.S. equities. It's gained momentum. It now has momentum of its own, a life of its own, and it just feeds upon itself, I think, like a bonfire. Unfortunately, all of that just looks like a mountain of inflation looking for a place, and eventually that has to work its way into the commodities sector, and particularly the precious metals. But, you know, I also wanted to ask you, if I could, about the oil plunge. You know, it certainly put a strain on the system, but it also lowers the cost of production for energy-intensive sectors and industries, such as precious metals mining. Do you see that as a potential positive?
Well, that actually is a good point. Like, I mean, I've been sort of studying this whole oil equation recently. I mean, I quite frankly did not foresee a $50 drop in the price of oil. And I think, for all the good things it's doing, it's putting more money in the consumer's pocket because he doesn't have to pay as much for his gas and his heating oil and what have you. But at the same time, there's so many financial implications to this that could be very negative in the sense. And the other point is that most of the job creation in the United States in the last 5 years has come in the fracking states. And I think fracking is in deep trouble if oil prices were to remain where they are. This is a real wild card that I don't think people fully understand.
You know, the Sprott Gold Miners ETF, SGDM ticker, has eclipsed apparently over $100 million in asset. It actually, it's the most successful new ETF of the year. It's only been around roughly 6 months now. Just such a huge number in, as far as assets are concerned. I'd like your thoughts as to why it is that investors have gravitated to this ETF.
Well, there's two reasons. Three reasons, really. I think your point earlier that I didn't answer was the fact that, yes, gold mining, will benefit from lower energy prices, because that has been one of the problems. Like, that's one of the costs that has already gotten somewhat out of control. But secondly, if you look at gold shares, I mean, related to the price of the metal, even though the metal is depressed, the gold shares are even more depressed. I think this is one of the greatest buying opportunities, if not the greatest buying opportunity in history for gold shares. But the third reason why our ETF is interesting is that generally they just take the indexes and they throw in whatever the index weights are. We are actually trying to choose the best gold stocks in the world to put into the ETF. And, I mean, I think you really have to differentiate on a quality basis, and that's what we're trying to do. I would encourage anybody that's listening to this, and I sound like I'm talking my own book, but I really believe that this is a phenomenal opportunity to get into a quality group of gold stocks at a remarkably good price.
Any other topicality, any other issues that you'd like to share with our listeners today as this dialogue winds down?
No, I would, other than to wish them all a happy new year, I think it's going to be a struggle, but a happy new year anyways. But the fact is that I just want to reiterate again, I mean, because of the terrible price action, much of which has been created in gold and silver and the shares, most people have just avoided the whole sector, and now there's just sort of distaste for it. This is one of the great opportunities in history, and I would encourage all the listeners to take advantage of it.
One way to take advantage for, you know, nervous folks, start allocating a small portion of equities profits from the past 4 or 5 years into the precious metals mining sector. And that's why I threw out that ticker symbol for folks because, you know, as you say, I mean, you all have specialized knowledge in the area and it could boost the bottom line in the coming years. John Embry, gosh, we thank you so much for taking time for us and we wish you continued success in 2015.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's nice chatting with you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Chris, this is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. It's officially 2015. Economic predictions and prognostications are coming in from all directions, but there's no urgency in the economy anywhere. Things are not operating smoothly for many people, as I again witnessed firsthand today. I was in for some routine tests at an off-site provider in conjunction with my annual physical, and a couple that was ahead of me were turned away for medical service. She was in a wheelchair and on assistance. He was her caregiver. Apparently, the system did not indicate she could get medical service today. He calmly explained who he had spoken to and how he was informed to arrive today. But it didn't matter. Her name was pending in the system, and the only way she could get service today was to pay a $400 copay, which they did not have, so they left. Increasingly, as we move forward, if, for whatever reason, you are not on the list, any list for any service, you could be denied access and potentially with little recourse. The gap between access and denial is growing stronger on a daily basis and still remains invisible to many. As the access-denial gap widens for many people, it is also widening for countries around the globe. There have been calls to expel Russia from the international SWIFT system, which is a global banking transaction system used by most international banks in 210 countries. However, on December 26th, it was announced that Russia's central bank will be launching its own SWIFT-style system within 6 months. If this comes to pass, economic battles the world over will continue to escalate throughout 2015. Reuters reported on December 30th that Venezuela's 12-month inflation reached 63.6% in November. Ouch. But elsewhere, European Central Bank President Mario Draghi said that the risk of deflation in the euro area has risen over the months, and the central bank is preparing to react to such a threat if necessary. He said, "We are in technical preparations to adjust the size, speed, and compositions of our measures at the start of 2015, should it become necessary to react to a too long period of low inflation. There is unanimity within the governing council on this," he said. It's good to know that the European Central Bank is ready to print the difference going into 2015, just as central banks everywhere are locking and loading their ability to create unlimited paper and digital snowstorms of currency. It's not a question of if this will happen, only when in 2015. And as these paper and mostly digital snowstorms of currency envelop the economies of the world, the one thing we must watch for are any new access denial gaps that emerge. Clearly, certain people and groups of people are and remain unable to access the mountain of QE that has been created the past 6 years. As more QE is created, it will require close observation to see which individuals, groups, companies, industries, and countries benefit from its creation, and which do not. The access denial gap is going to grow, and is going to be a major theme of 2015 and beyond. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.